You're in tune with KVMR FM Nevada City 105 on this Wednesday. 79 degrees out there. We got bike talk coming up here with Chris Kelly in just a moment. But first, we got to read the community calendar. The Ginger Ninjas will kick off their new bicycle-powered international music tour at Sun Sound Studios on Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. For more information, visit www.pleasantrevolution.net. That's a nice one to start the community calendar off,
I would
huh?
say so, yeah. Why don't you go next, Kurt?
We have the 19th annual Sierra Brew Fest coming up. It will be held at the Nevada County Fairgrounds from 3 to 6 p.m. this Saturday. The event includes 90 microbrews for the tasting and music by Bob Mora and the Third Degree for dancing. So we've got beer and dancing. What better combination could you have?
Two good things. Wow. And then we have Brandon Phillips and his band, the Fast Rattler, to celebrate the music of his father, Utah Phillips, this Friday night at the Miner's Foundry, Stone Hall. Sharing the night is local American roots rock musician Lee Bob Watson. Sorry about that, Lee Bob. For more information, you can go to NevadaCityMusicEvents.com.
Deadline to apply for KVMR's National Radio Program Production Funding Grants is Monday, August 25th. For information, visit KVMR's website at kvmr.org or call 530-265-9073, extension 211.
Victoria Hunt, author of the new book Animal Omens, will discuss and sign her book on Saturday at 6 p.m. at the Sacred Bee in Grass Valley. For details, see www.thesacredbee.com.
Vining Cottage will perform at the Nevada County Certified Growers Market at the Fairgrounds, Gate 4, this Saturday from 8 a.m. until noon. And for more info on that, you can go to thegrowersmarket.com.
And then we have Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks plus Roy Rogers and the Delta Rhythm Kings perform the 6th annual Stars at the Peak benefit concert for the Nevada County Land Trust this Saturday at the Pilot Peak Winery in Penn Valley, and the doors will open at 5 p.m. Music is at 7 p.m. For information, call toll-free at 888-695-0888.
Local musicians Aaron Ross and The Mole will play at The Basement in Nevada City this Saturday. They will be joined by Sacramento's Dead Western and ex-Nevada City resident Oak Ross. Phone 292-9293 for info.
Local country band The Dying Breed plays at The Grey Goose in Alta Sierra on Saturday at 9 p.m. Call 274-9120 for more information.
The old Grey Goose, huh?
We have the Grass Valley and Nevada City Elks holding a soccer shoot for kids under 14 years of age at the Chicago Park School on Sunday. If you need more information on that, you can check out grassvalleyelks.org.
To pan for gold and experience the life of treasure hunter, George would love this. You can go to Lifetime Ranch at 17860 Cattle Drive in Penn Valley on Saturday and Sunday. Proceeds will benefit the LifetimeFoundation.org, which provides assistance to women and children in need. For details, call 432-7383.
Nevada County's own 10-piece Afro-Cuban jazz and salsa band, Sabroso, will perform Friday at the North Columbia Cultural Center on the San Juan Ridge. Grupo Omo Ache will open the show at 7:30 p.m. Please call 478-9574 for more information.
The Ludi Hendricks Jazz Trio, comprised of Ludi, Tim Winter, and Greg Karanin, performs an evening of basses, bosses, bebop, and bone at the Copper Top Lounge in Grass Valley this Saturday, 8 to 11 p.m. For more information, see www.coppertoplounge.com.
Those guys are good, by the way. I've heard them. And I've got one more, and that is this week at the Center for the Arts, downtown Grass Valley, Friday, a CD release concert featuring the Naked Band with Charissa Hart and Christian Sun, 8 p.m. Saturday morning, the Children's Series presents Touched by a Child, Enchanted Forest at 10 a.m. Saturday evening, a tribute concert to The Who, featuring Who Done It at 8 p.m. For information, call 274-8384. And that's all for Community Calendar.
All right. KVMR's Community Calendar lists entertainment, fundraising, and arts events in Western Nevada County. It's heard weekdays at 6:30 a.m., weekends at 7:30 a.m., and daily at 1 and 5:30 p.m. We have an easy-to-use online submission form at our website, kvmr.org. Please list events or public service announcements 2 or more weeks in advance. That's kvmr.org. And here at KVMR, we're getting ready for Bike Talk. It's our second installment. Chris Kelly's bringing that to us.
Here we are.
Before we get started, let's thank Foothill Flowers, serving Western Nevada County since 1966 at 102 West Main Street, downtown Grass Valley. Foothill Flowers is an FTD and Teleflora agent offering worldwide delivery. They can be reached at 530-273-2296 or foothillflowers.com. So we got bike builder extraordinaire Chris Kelly in here bringing his bike talk to us again. Also in studio, Janelle Black from People Power Transportation and Kirk Stockton from the U.S. Core States Pro Champion and former Sierra Nevada Pro Cycling Team Director. And what's going to be on the bill today, Chris?
Well, we've got a pretty jam-packed bill today. We've got some really great guests in the studio here and one that's on the line waiting for us to chime him in, and that's George Mount. But first, let me introduce my guests in the studio. To my right, my returning guest, Janelle Black from People Power Transportation, who helped me pilot the first show here of Bike Talk. She's back in the studio. Give a hello there, Janelle.
Hi.
And then over to my left here, I've got Kurt Stockton. And I've been friends with Kurt for a lot of years, but he is the 1990 U.S. Pro Champion, and he's had a really esteemed career since the early, well, the late 80s, mid 80s,
early
90s, 80s. Early 80s to early 90s.
Yeah. Mid to late 90s racing mountain bikes as well as on the road.
Righto. And then on the phone, we've got George Mount calling us down from the 408. And he was the first Olympian, let me rephrase that. He was the first U.S. cyclist, the first American to go to the Olympics and actually place, which basically paved the way for everybody to follow. And he's so basically, in my mind, he's a pioneer in that whole arena. And he's got a lot more accomplishments, but I'm more a friend to George than somebody who knows his career. The extent of our relationship is we try to figure out who makes the best barbecue ribs when he comes to my house. So I'm going to let George take it from there and say hello. George, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. How you doing, Kurt and Janelle? Everybody fine up there in beautiful Nevada City?
Great.
Yeah, we're doing wonderful.
I wish I was up there with you guys.
It finally cooled down a little bit.
Yeah.
So you have a computer nearby there, George?
I got a computer nearby.
All right. So first thing I want to do is just on the Kelly Bike News page, I've got a really great photo of you that, I don't know, it's just been kind of psyching me up for this week's show. And this picture, until I was talking to Kurt about it on the telephone yesterday, I was like, who is that? And Kurt named off who the guy leaning over your bike was. And I'm looking at this jersey you're wearing. It says Coors Classic on it. Was that the leader's jersey, George?
Chris, honestly, I got Beckheimer's disease. I can't exactly remember what that jersey was.
Beckheimer's, wow, that's
yeah.
Is that a rare?
Not amongst my associates.
yeah.
It's Coors was the sponsor. Could have been a leader of some sort in that race, the Tour of Colorado. But the picture you got there is me having a wheel change in the race, and I'm actually helping the mechanic get the wheel on the bike, and it's a good dynamic picture because although it's kind of static, you can see the chain, the wheel, all this stuff in motion at the same time. And, of course, you can polish Bill Woodall's head there, his bald head leaning over the bike. For those who know him, he's no longer with us, but it's a great picture of him in action doing what he did best.
Yeah, you guys look like you're both into it, just making it go. Kurt was mentioning that's who it was yesterday. Kurt, you know Bob Woodall.
Bill Woodall, yeah.
Bill Woodall, sorry.
I met Bill back when I was a junior cyclist going back to Colorado Springs to the Olympic Training Center, and Bill used to... He ran a technical support program for an Italian component manufacturer, Campagnolo, and he was the one that drove these big Buick station wagons around the country and supported the bike races, doing technical support. What he was doing there, helping George change a wheel. And he's just one of those guys, you know, who always offered a helping hand and was a very wonderful individual from the very get-go with cycling in the U.S., and it was sad to see him go from cancer a few years back.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe we get Brian over there to cut the background music, although that's good stuff. By the way, the first songs you heard coming in were from a group called Motherbug. They were in a Bay Area band. One of the guys was my next-door neighbor in Oakland, so I just wanted to give them a mention before I moved on. George, the other thing in this photo that really that captures me as well is I think the jerseys you're wearing are wool. Is that a wool jersey?
No, I don't think so. I think that was some sort of synthetic. That was actually post-wool. Certainly a couple of years before that, the typical cyclist's accoutrement was wool shorts and wool jersey.
Yeah.
The nice double knit. The best stuff was the stuff that came from Italy. And it was great in hot weather, and it was great in warm weather. People don't know how great wool is as a material.
Telling you.
It was only not great when it rained.
And not to mention it looks great.
Well, you know, everything was embroidered, done by hand back then. Totally different era, different type of stuff. I think you notice I barely have a helmet on there. There's a little bit of a helmet on my head, and it's actually made of patent leather and stuff with horse hair.
They call that a hairnet, huh?
Yeah, and they got you by the rules. But even at that. If you're looking at that picture, that's a year when I was actually professional in Italy, and I was racing the Tour Colorado. And in Italy, we didn't really even wear helmets at all.
Right. Helmets just became mandatory in the Tour de France only a couple few years ago.
Yeah. Helmets didn't really work back then. And nowadays, if you don't wear a helmet, I don't know, I'm sort of, you know, being a motorcyclist and a bicyclist, I'm of the opinion that if you have any brains at all, you should wear a helmet. But if you don't want to wear a helmet, I guess that's kind of okay with me, as long as they're willing to pay for the spatula fee to clean you up off the ground.
Indeed. And being a father, too, at the same time, you want to be there for your kids. So I tend to wear a helmet a lot more than I used to as well. Your toe clips and your non-aero brake levers on here really tell the date, though. But let's get back to your days, leading up to the Olympics. Let's just go back. When did you start racing a bike?
Well, it's an Olympic year now, so this is appropriate. We've got the games going on in Beijing, so I'll talk a little bit about what led up to me going to the Olympics. And frankly, there wasn't a lot of coverage on TV back in the 70s for the Olympics, at least as far as I know. I didn't watch a lot of TV, so maybe it was just me. But I started riding bikes in the Bay Area in the 70s, and got out of high school and managed to avoid Henry Kissinger in the draft. For Vietnam just through luck and perseverance, wound up getting enough notice nationally to get selected for the Pan American team the year before, and then the Olympics in 76. Also, winning a couple of the events for selection didn't hurt.
Right.
Although that isn't always in most sports, that isn't always the ultimate decider of who makes the Olympic team, and that's just as much true for cycling as it is for a lot of sports.
An awful lot of politics involved then.
Awful lot of politics. And
more than people know.
Yeah. When I actually competed in the Olympics, the interesting thing that I discovered was that none of the American riders, no one had placed in the top 60 since 1912. And the big thing was the trials. And unfortunately, a lot of the sports, not just in the United States, the trials becomes the end-all, see-all, and a lot of athletes in many sports burn themselves out at the trials and have nothing left for the actual games.
Right.
It's a delicate balancing act to find the best athletes, hence the politics being involved, too. The coaches have to look at past performances as well as current capabilities. But when I went to the Olympics, I decided, this is BS. There's no reason an American can't compete with the Europeans. I had enough people tell me that Europeans were genetically superior, that my bones weren't big enough or my bones were too small.
Yeah, I heard that story. It's one of my favorites. Please elaborate.
Yeah. Well, there's just, a lot of people, are willing to give you advice and they really don't have any information to back it up. And a lot of people encouraged me to not succeed. And those people just irritated me to the point where, if you're watching the Olympics now, the great interview with Michael Phelps the other night where some guy got him mad because he overheard him trash-talking the American team for the last event, and it just made them all go that much harder.
Yeah.
And he uses that, and as an athlete, you try to use those things as a tool to make yourself better at what you're doing. And I did the same thing. I was interviewed before the Olympics. The big thing was I had competed with all the guys who were going to, almost all the teams that were going to compete in the Olympics. I competed with them in South America the year before in that spring. So I knew I could handle it. I knew I would place well if I didn't have any bad luck. And I stated that for the cycling press. The cycling press, of course, cycling, there was a total of, grand total of less than 10,000 people that had racing licenses back then in the United States.
Wow.
The cycling press was predominantly an East Coast phenomenon, and they didn't look kindly on West Coast riders. They were particularly incensed that a number of riders over the years had come out of California and gone to Europe and done fairly well, not just myself, but even before me.
Mm-hmm.
We're all under a microscope now with blogs and the internet and so on and so forth. But back then, there wasn't a lot of coverage in little sport and so on.
Right, the communications being what they are these days.
It's a real different game right now. I mean, I when I went over to Europe, I wouldn't hear from people for months.
Wow, yeah.
Nobody had any idea what I was doing over there.
Oh, even still, when friends of mine went to Europe in the 80s, you know, when I was just into it, getting into racing, and I wouldn't hear from them. I'd be lucky if I got a postcard in the mail or something like that, which was always a treat, you know, but it's nothing like now where you just hit someone with an email and they're hitting you right back about 5 minutes later.
Yeah. So, you know, and I grew up in Berkeley, so cycling in Berkeley back then, but cycling as a way of commuting, cycling as a way of getting around town, cycling as a sport was my life. And, it was, going to the Olympics was interesting, and I did well, and I, you know, got sixth place in the road race, 112-mile race, the pouring rain.
Wow.
As usual, none of the other Americans finished. in fact, the hardest, the most difficult time in the race was when my own teammates were chasing me down.
Oh, God.
Because for the Americans, it was all about, you know, who was going to last longer in the race than the American team, because that was bragging rights.
They didn't even get the whole thing that, hey, we could probably win. If we think this thing through a little bit,
that wasn't the point for them. So,
right.
The big thing in the cycling world is it sort of made a very public statement. I mean, Jim McKay did a 15-minute piece on me, and so on. So it actually took the sport national to some degree, and sort of made that statement of, you know, this whole East Coast cycling attitude is a bunch of BS. There's no reason that Americans can't be competitive with the Europeans, and
the West Coasters.
Well, the West Coast pretty much led the way as far as that goes, although there were some good track riders from the East Coast. And, you know, cycling was a big sport in this country before World War II and the automobile.
Correct.
Used to be 8 velodromes in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Up the East Bay, there were from Fremont to, or from Hayward to Oakland to Berkeley, there was a number of them I heard that, were demoed. You know.
Yeah, well, the old Polo Grounds in San Francisco is actually a bicycle training track built in 1906.
Oh, man.
Still there, has a 3-degree banking. It's about a half mile long. But you can't ride a bike on it. It's too full of potholes and talker players.
You know, at this time, I want to invite people to call in and talk to George, talk to any one of us in the studio about what we're talking about today. Or if you have something else you want to bring up, that'd be great, too. But it seems that an hour will burn through quick. So I want to give some call numbers here for people that are in the area, in their cars, want to talk to us. The number here at the station that you can call in and talk live to George or myself or Court or Janelle is 530-265-9555. And the 800 number for anyone in Northern California is 800-355-KVMR, and the number is actually 5867. So that's 265-9555 in the 530 area code. We look forward to speaking with you. Please call in. George, you were up a few weeks ago, and we were talking about you and the early parts of your career. And the one story I really liked is where you're telling me how, you know, it was about lifestyle. And Kurt can relate to this, I'm sure, because he raced and I raced too. And it's a lifestyle change when you're a bike racer. And I like the story you were telling me about when you lived upstairs at VeloNews and had a hot plate and a coffee maker.
Oh, we had a toaster oven too.
Oh, well, we can't forget the toaster oven, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, we can do without everything except the toaster oven.
It's amazing how little you can live with if you want to. And, you know, that goes for cars too.
Okay, looks, we got a couple callers calling in. Why don't we take a couple calls, George? You into that?
Sure.
Okay. You're live on the air on KVMR.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, my name is Sue. I just wanted to know, did you know Fred Markham, who raced in 1976?
I knew Fred Markham.
No, Fast Freddy was on the team.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
He was my next door neighbor growing up, and I swore I was going to marry him.
Well, he's got five daughters now.
I know it. And he's got a daughter who is racing, I guess.
No, I didn't even know that. I'm kind of out of touch.
He's doing the Fast Freddy. It's the huge, I don't know what to call it, it's like a big bike that he's gone through the Bonneville.
Oh, yeah, he does the speed. He was the first guy to break the 55-mile-an-hour speed record at the Salt Flats
exactly.
or whatever.
Yeah. Is he in Bonneville right now?
No, he raced in Paris last year, and I don't know exactly. I'm from Las Gatas, where he's from, and I last saw him at my high school reunion about a year ago, and so he caught me up on what he was doing, and he last raced in Paris, but now has his older daughter who is doing the same kind of racing as he did in the Bonneville Flat.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
I know, but well, I didn't hear him.
Yeah, He told me the worst crash he ever had was inside you're essentially encased inside an envelope of Kevlar.
Yeah.
And I walked up to me, he had some terrible crash marks on his leg, and I said, what happened? And he goes, no, those aren't crash marks, they're burn marks, because when
salt.
You crash at 60 miles an hour on this Kevlar, he says you're enclosed, you can actually smell your skin start to cook.
Whoa.
So it was the weirdest, creepiest thing he'd ever been involved in.
That is bizarre. I know, and it's a very, it's not like just being on a bike. I don't mean just, but it's...
No, I've done those races. It's a whole different world.
Wow.
Land speed record things are a crack up.
You know,
yeah.
Kurt, you know Freddie as well, don't you?
Yeah, I knew Freddie a little bit later on in his career. I actually raced with a little while with him, and there was someone that put together a cycling league called the National Cycling League, and they were trying to have city-based teams kind of modeled after the NFL or the NBA and television and that. And actually, that was where I met Freddie a little bit further in his career. But he was, I think, just as crazy then as he is now, trying to race on the Salt Flats.
Yeah, he was very driven. I know that.
That's great.
Anyway, I just had to call in. I thought your show was so cool. I just happened to turn it on while I'm driving. I'm actually driving and talking to my cell phone at the same time you're not supposed to do. But
well, you better get yourself an earpiece now.
I know.
Where are you driving? Whereabouts are you, just out of curiosity?
I'm in Roseville.
Oh, okay.
Near Sacramento area.
You're catching us all the way down in Roseville then.
Yeah.
That's great.
Very cool.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right. So, George, back to the toaster and the hot plate.
Yeah, that was Freddie's. Yeah, he described that was one of the more bizarre things I'd ever heard.
Yeah, yeah, the Kevlar,
Freddie being toasted like he's on a hot plate. when I got started racing, there's a bike shop in Berkeley, and this guy had coached a lot of very good riders, and he let me live upstairs, and we had a shower, and we had a toaster, and we had a hot plate. And
yeah,
we had
Peter Rich.
Yeah, Peter Rich, Bellasport. Sport. And,
great shot.
Before me, he had coached Mike Neal, who was a guy who did well internationally and helped me get over into Italy back in the late 70s. And before that, it was a guy named Dave Brink, who I think lives in Davis now, who was really a phenomenal athlete with a lot of talent. But like a lot of people back then, got distracted at some point in his cycling career and went off to do other things.
Mm. Happens.
Well, there wasn't a lot. You couldn't make much money in cycling back then, even in my day.
Right.
You did it for the passion. You did it because you liked to get up every day and get on your bike and go ride. And then you also had to have that passion for racing and winning.
Right. And there's a lot of people that are listening today that probably ride bikes. They've looked at the website and they know what kind of mileage a rider puts in and if they're going to be competitive in the racing scene. But just go over that, like your lifestyle.
Well, I mean, there's three different things in there, and something that all cyclists share is that passion for being out on a bike. And I don't think anybody needs to describe what that is. I think everybody feels the same thing. I mean, there's nothing better than getting out for a bike ride. nothing. It's nice. And the fitter you get, the longer you can ride, the more pleasant it is to ride on the roads and the less hassle you have with cars, the more fun it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, then you've got to have that passion for competition, which a lot of people have. But the vast majority of them lack the passion for winning that is more of a dementia than anything.
Yeah.
And then a very small group of people suffer from, you know, that particular disorder called the desire to be first.
Yeah. Well, so let's go into the Coors Classic. Was that a favorite of yours as far as U.S. racing goes?
Not particularly. At the time it was the only multiple day race in the United States Tour Colorado. First it was the Red Zinger. Mo Siegel from Celestial Seasonings put it on. Eventually it sort of got big, so he managed to talk the Coors family into sponsoring it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was a good race. I mean, the last couple times I rode it, we rode it actually. It was like, what was it, 8 days long or something like that. I came back from Italy with an Italian team, and we rode it as sort of a relaxation after the tour of Italy.
I bet.
But it was a lot of fun. I mean, you know, I got my picture in Rolling Stone magazine because of it.
That's cool.
So yeah, you know, considering all my rock and roll friends from high school never, you know, with all our garage bands, never made it into Rolling Stone.
And here you are, this geeky bike rider guy with wire rim glasses, and you make it into Rolling Stone.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and that's what it's all about, right?
It is what it's all about.
Didn't give me any girls, but hey.
Yeah. So, on to the Olympics these days. You know, what's the contrast, George? I mean, you know, seems that back then we didn't get much coverage, and things really haven't changed that much from what.
I wouldn't know looking at NBC's coverage. I've seen virtually no cycling. You can't figure out when anything is. Everyone I talk to says I've given up. You know.
Jeez.
But I'm sure that outside of the United States, the coverage is well slated and good. And you know, the interesting thing I noticed about the Olympics this year, if you look at the events, I've watched it some, a smattering of events, and you see the tremendous amount of empty seats in many of the stadiums for many of the sports.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did, you know, the few times we've been able to see the bicycle track racing and so on and the BMX, everything's packed, just absolutely packed. People in the United States don't seem to understand that cycling outside of North America is you know, right up there with soccer in terms of participation and people who like to watch it. I mean, the bicycle is a big part of everybody's life around the world, except in the United States. And, you know, not just racing, but everywhere. And people have a lot of affinity for bike racing because of that. And it's a shame that the racing community is sort of self-destructing with all the drugs that are involved in it. But the only real difference between the cycling community and that is that they're actually trying to clean it up as opposed to some sports that are trying to hide it.
Yeah, that's right. Looks like we have a caller calling in again.
Sure.
You're live on KVMR.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say that, like, with the post-oil age coming up,
mm-hmm.
I think biking's just going to get bigger and bigger. My son lives in Long Beach. He's involved with the critical mass. Not so much the racing. My friend's husband races, and I just think ecologically and for the future, like, biking is the sport of the future.
Oh, well, you know, for years, for many, many years ago, we had this great vision when they put I-5 in. We thought it'd be great. They're going to turn one side of I-5 into an endless row of volleyball courts, and the other side will be all recumbent, you know, multiple bicycles. Just, you know, you could cruise at 40 miles an hour between San Francisco and L.A. on that freeway.
All day long.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine these five-seat recumbent bikes with, you know, with everybody just sitting there listening to the radio and riding about
that.
40 miles an hour?
Chime in, Janelle.
You know, and that's where the Fast Freddy thing fits in. You know, they can put those kind of enclosures around those things. That would be so cool.
Yeah.
It would be way cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just had a quick time, and I just wanted to mention that.
All right. Where are you calling from?
Roseville.
All right. Roseville again. Put a shout out to Roseville. Roseville, keep on calling.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for that.
You guys have a great day. Bye.
All right.
Thanks.
You too.
Well, I think, this is Kurt here, I think that caller made a good point. She was saying that her son rides, but he's more involved in the critical mass side, and she does have a friend whose husband races bikes. I think it's important to realize that I think what we're trying to get at with bike talk here is that it's a bicycle no matter what you use it for, you know. When I was a kid, we rode our bikes to school, and, you know, I was always very competitive, so, of course, I went into racing. My parents, they raced motocross back in the 70s, so my brother and I, you know, on the weekends we go to the track and ride our BMX bikes around, but we'd also ride to school, and we'd use the bikes to get around, to go from one friend's house to another.
Yeah.
And George made the point that, you know, the bicycle everywhere else in the world is huge, and I think this sedentary lifestyle that most of the people here in the U.S. are into, they don't look at the bicycle other than some kind of form of recreation, but not actually something to get things done. But I think the biggest point is it doesn't matter if you're, you know, you're racing, you're commuting, you're involved with critical mass, you ride a mountain bike or a city bike. We're all doing the same thing. We're all on two wheels, and I think that's very important.
Yeah, the only new bike I bought in the last 20 years was a one-speed coaster brake bike I bought for $50 recently and put baskets on it.
That's great.
Going to the grocery store, and, you know, that's great.
Yeah, looks like we have another caller coming
in. Yeah, another caller calling in. You're live on, go ahead, Kurt.
You're live on KVMR. Who are we talking to?
This is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, I haven't been listening for a couple of minutes, but if you want to include MSNBC and CNBC and USA networks, they've been showing a lot of bicycling.
You don't know when it's going to be. You have to watch all the stations.
Well,
at least on my Dish network that I have, I can't say, oh, look, you know, cycling event at this time.
The trick is I use zaptoit.com, and I programmed into that the stations I get here. And if you get to any one of those events and you click on it, it'll give you a complete listing of everything that they're broadcasting.
Oh, really? Oh, that's good.
And so I've watched a Madison, which I've never seen before, Points Race, Cureton, Individual Pursuit, Team Pursuit. So I've seen all those kinds of races.
Oh, good.
So they are out there. You have to work a little bit to get them. But, yes, they are available.
I bet you the Cureton was good.
So yeah, I'm not a big TV watcher, so I just kind of checked it out, and I've gotten real disappointed. But I'll check that out.
I'm an Olympic junkie, so I watched just about the whole thing.
Which was your favorite cycling event that you watched?
It surprised me that the sprint races are good.
Match sprint.
Yeah. Surprised me that I enjoyed was the team pursuit.
Yeah.
I mean, the pursuits are usually It's unfortunate they broadcast these little snippets. They don't let you see the whole thing.
They don't let you get
a view of it. But the team pursuit was kind of cool.
Well, that's an incredible precision event too. I mean,
yeah.
You get these two teams of four riders going around this track. I don't know what size the track is in Beijing, if it's 250 meters or it's a little bit bigger. But these guys are going around at almost 40 miles an hour, pulling off every, 10 seconds. It's pretty phenomenal to watch.
Yeah, they've had some good coverage, and at least they've been showing it, and they showed some of the road stuff.
Okay, so zaptoit.com, you can figure out where to go from there. Then.
Yeah. Program in your local station.
I appreciate that.
And then go from there.
We have another caller.
Good.
We have a caller on hold. Okay, you're live on KVMR.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your self-motivation and, when you're at the end of a race and you're really tired, your body's aching and you're feeling tired. And what sort of, self-talk and motivational thing do you do to keep yourself going?
I think, that varies for each individual, but it's what drives you. Why are you there in the first place, and what are you trying to achieve? Keeping that in focus, and you also have to realize you're at the end of an event and you're suffering. You know, your legs are burning, you're breathing hard.
You're supposed to be hurting.
You are, but every other person around you is the same. And it's usually every once in a while you get these people that are just phenomenal and they can ride away. But mostly it's the one that can suffer just a little bit longer than everyone else that gets there. And I see people that do that in life. They take hard work and they embrace it and want to get it done, and that translates into cycling as well. It's a nice analogy.
I think one of the things in cycling for me was that cycling is a very complex event that has many factors that influence the outcome. At any moment, those factors change constantly. You can start in a warm race and finish in a wet cold race. And you never know how some of the factors are going to play out. And as you get to the end, you begin to see it's as if people are laying cards out on the table. Mm. And as a cyclist, for me, the motivation was to look at all those factors and almost act in a very scientific manner to calculate what the possibilities were, what was going to happen. And again, it's constantly changing. I don't think there's any sport that has more factors that influence the outcome than something like a bicycle road race. So for me, it was constantly running the calculations, figuring out the numbers, looking at the combinations, and then if you're going to win, that's just something. I've beat many riders who are way better than I am. I've started many races with riders who are much better racers than I was, but they didn't have that will and desire. And that, I don't think you can calculate it. It just has to be in you.
You got something clicking on your end there, George?
Yeah, I would have to agree about that, too. There's so much that goes on. Being a team manager the last 4 years, I have a dozen riders that race for me, and at the start of each race, we have a race plan. We have a meeting. We go in with the plan. But I always say the coolest thing about bike racing is that it's so predictably unpredictable.
I think I agree with both of you guys. And you know, when I was racing, which, you know, I hit category two, and then I got busy building bikes, and I went into the bike building business. But I'll tell you one thing is that it's just like what both of you were saying is I would do a little bit of both. And for me, when I came out of a race that was really tough, a rained-out race, or if I got a flat tire and had to ride 60 or 80 miles in by myself, you know, out in the middle of Fresno somewhere, it wasn't really too motivating. But I'll tell you one thing is that all the while, the years that I was psyched about doing it, was that I just kept in my mind that I was living my dream. I was doing what I wanted to be doing. And then when it stopped being that, that's when I stopped bike racing. So, you know, maybe the deal is that you do it until you're not having fun at it. If it stops becoming fun, then you do something else. And, you know, that's okay, too.
Yeah, cycling is way too difficult to do it if you're not enjoying yourself, you're not having fun.
That's right.
Yeah, to put yourself through that, you know, through the training to get you so that you can do those races, you know. So that's great. George went to the Olympics, but the hours in the saddle, the amount of time,
man.
You know, the tires you wore out.
6 hours a day, easy.
Oh, yeah, or six, seven, day after day after day.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, so you do have to really enjoy what you're doing. And, a lot of time out on the road, it also gives you a lot of time to think. So it's not like it's a decision that you made spur of the moment and you just do it. It's got to be ingrained. You have to love it.
Yeah, just to give you an idea, when I was racing on an Italian team professionally in Italy, out of a year, 365 days, we had, of the 3 years I raced professional each year, averaged about 160 days of racing.
Wow.
And the average distance, if you take all of the events and average them out, was about 150 miles per race.
That's amazing.
So I don't think that the calendar is quite as long nowadays for the riders, but you know, there was times you'd be racing 40 out of 50 days.
Well, now you have cyclocross, but that's a completely different thing. Let's break it down into the numbers, though, like we're talking. There are 52 weeks in a year. That means there's 110 days of weekend racing. So you're racing 165 or 67, did you say?
Yeah, about 160 races a year. But, you know, as a professional, you don't race just, I mean, you're, you know, the big tours are 22, 23 days long.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying, you're racing all through a week at a stage race where you're going on a 5-day, 6-day, 7-day tour or longer if it's a big tour. Like Tour of Italy is how long?
It's 23 days.
Yeah, it's just like the Tour de France, except it's just, you know, in Italy.
It's harder.
And you got more Italians.
Yeah, the food's better.
Yeah. Did you like that aspect of racing in Italy?
Well, you don't get a chance to really indulge in the quality foods there. You eat a pretty basic diet, a lot of white rice and white pasta.
That's bike racing.
Chicken and so on.
Yeah.
You don't have time to play around with fancy foods or drink a lot of wine.
Boy, that's why I enjoy not being a bike racer anymore.
Well, that's why I'm put on a little weight over the years.
Not you.
Trying to make up for it.
You like that microbrew. That's the deal.
Yeah.
Well, George, what do you see the biggest difference, you know, competing? You competed in the Olympics in 76, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? In Montreal. And here we are 32 years later. It doesn't seem... I said now that what we call the Lance factor is kind of come and gone with Lance Armstrong, and cycling isn't as popular as it was when Lance was racing, because he had a mainstream appeal with his battle against cancer. What do you see as the big difference as why we're not getting as much publicity as we think cycling should 32 years later from when you raced the Olympics until now?
I think, first of all, you're talking... The discussion is restricted essentially to North American publicity.
That's what I mean.
If you look at it on a worldwide basis, that's not necessarily the case. But, you know, cycling really, even during your Lance times and your Le Mans times, got a very restricted amount of coverage for a very short period of time. If you look at the whole year, you know, cycling just needs to be, it isn't, and it needs to be more ingrained in our nature and what we want to do. And, you know, that's why you have Janelle here, although she hasn't talked much, but... What she does is equally important to promoting the sport, as the sport is to promoting bicycling in general.
That's right. That's what I was thinking as you were talking about the whole, you know, as we were talking about mentally preparing ourselves after a race. And I'm thinking, you know, when it stopped being fun, I was so glad to go in and doing what I was doing now. And I just enjoy this whole real world thing a lot more than I do bike racing. I enjoy watching the bike racing and going to it, and I still get the jitters going there. But it's neat, you know, just helping people, you know, facilitate and figure out what's a good ride. And that's why I'm enjoying the show so much. And
yeah,
people,
I mean,
like Janelle and Kurt has the same views too. So
I think cycling is interesting this year in that BMX has now been added, which is could possibly bring in a whole slew of new people, although I'm not sure because a lot of those kids move on to motocross.
Mm-hmm.
And that sport has been sort of outside of the cycling thing. There's women's cycling now. There's professional cycling in the Olympics. It's different, but it doesn't seem as if there's a lot more coverage, specifically of cycling. They've expanded their coverage to sports outside of basketball and, you know, things like that. But you still see, I mean, a lot of coverage of sports that people don't do in the United States. Much less than cycling.
Looks like we got another caller coming in here, but I just wanted to say I think cycling is a lot more interesting right now because fuel is $5 a gallon. Man, everybody's thinking about that.
People to start writing.
Yeah, and you're live on KVMR.
All right, thank you very much. I'm a hand cranker myself. I'm in a wheelchair and use a hand crank bike.
All right.
But my question was about what do you thought about Floyd Landis and, you know, the, I don't know, just is it like what, I watched the Tour de France real regularly and them, like, totally editing him out of all coverage. I mean, it's like he never, ever raced.
It's crazy.
Well, there's a business connection in there, and if you'll notice, the day after Floyd Landis, or the day before Floyd Landis was called in positive, which happened a couple of days after they supposedly took the test, he had turned down an offer for a sponsorship to be on an American team that was the same team, same people that sponsored Lance that essentially even today own the Lance franchise. Those people also own the TV rights. They own the USA Cycling Organization to a great deal. And Floyd pissed off those powers, and since they own USA Cycling, they own the media coverage between the Tour de France and the United States TV stations, TV people. Floyd, by pissing off those people, essentially just cut himself out of the sport of cycling.
Yeah, because I read his biography, and that's he really sounded like him and Lance didn't really see eye to eye because he was trying to get stuff for the teams and for himself and stuff. And
and it's all about Lance.
It sounded like the testing was a little funky. I mean, I know it's his side of the story, but it was a little one-sided on the testing too.
Well, I'm not saying the guy didn't take something, what he got busted for was pretty improbable.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to that story that we'll probably never know. But knowing a lot of the personalities involved and knowing the cult of Lance and the people involved, without mentioning any names, I'd have to say that, you know, there's some fingers that can be pointed to certain people.
Some heavy politics, yeah.
Because, I mean, it was just amazing to me that, like, I mean, I watched it the following year, and it's like he never even was in the race.
Yeah.
I mean, even, like, the coverage where you might see him in the background, it was like, you know, very seldom would you ever even see, like, a flash of him. You know, it was almost like he didn't ever exist. It was really kind of weird.
Yeah, that's something that I noticed in the tour coverage this year, that the one I watched it on Versus, formerly OLN, and, you know, although I like all the commentators and it's colorful, but, you know, the one blip I didn't really care for was we're going to take it back again or something like that, and it's all about the sport being clean. It was this musical thing going off, and Floyd's taking off his yellow jersey, and all the riders are stepping down from the podium and handing things back, and I just found that just so distasteful. You know, that I personally think that you know, some of these writers get crucified beyond belief to and it's so unwarranted.
Well, I mean, the guy must have lost a fortune.
Oh, absolutely,
he lost his life. You know,
endorsements and stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Someone took his livelihood away from him. You know, and that's not right.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously not. You know, he's got his issues. The kind of junk they pulled on Le Mans and stuff like that. I mean, there's not a lot of cleanliness around in that whole group. But it's pretty obvious the sequence of events and the characters involved that, you know, he pissed a particular person off, and you know, that person had him wiped from the sport of cycling.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're referring to Good Old Boy Network.
Yep.
Well, I just was just curious what your guys' take on that was. It just was wild. I know I have a hand crank bike. I do quite a few. I ride down here to Lincoln a lot, so I just was kind of curious what you guys thought.
We think it's cool you called in. And,
All right. Yeah,
that you're hand cranking out there. That's a good job.
Well, when I lived in Italy, I used to see there used to be all these cool old guys who cruise around on these little hand crank bikes/wheelchairs things in the towns, and those guys could get around anywhere. It was great.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty fun. I go, I do 6 to 10 miles a day just around local town here. And so it's pretty fun.
I'm not arm wrestling you.
All right. You guys have a good day. Thanks.
Great. Right. Thank you. Looks like we have another caller coming in.
Nope. It's coming down to the closing time here of the show, it being 1:51, or do we have a few more minutes here? Okay, that was like the 2-minute bell, I think. The 10-minute warning, the 5-minute warning.
One lap to go.
George, I want to ask you some things, just some basic down to earth everyday stuff. You live in Livermore now.
Yep.
And this is going to bring Janelle into the loop here. How easy is it or difficult is it to ride in Livermore? I remember when I was in Livermore driving the car around, it's like everything's a freeway there, it seems like.
No. Livermore has the best riding in the Bay Area. It's the slowest growth city.
There you go.
In the San Francisco Bay Area, I can be out my door and on flats or hills in 5 to 10 minutes. There's a lot of cyclists in the community. It's a great place. A lot of bike paths for my kids right out the door.
Even getting around town there, you don't find it's that hectic?
No, it's a little hard getting over the freeway, but getting around town, they've actually done a good job of laying things out, and the community's pretty involved in that. There's a lot of kids in the community, and so there's a couple BMX tracks and skateboard tracks and stuff, so it's really actually pretty well laid out. A lot of shoulders, which is, the big thing on the roads.
No, they got shoulders over there.
Ooh,
did you hear that?
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, when I come up to Nevada City, it's like, where are the shoulders? I mean, how do you get around town? I don't mind the hills. What I mind is the people opening the doors on me and running me off the road, and there's no shoulders.
Yeah.
There's definitely, we could definitely use some shoulder improvements and some more bike-friendly roads around here.
Yeah, and it seems like a great opportunity to turn some of those roads into, bike. I used to commute through Palo Alto and Mountain View on essentially a bike route that was also a car route, but they put up enough barriers that I could commute almost as fast as you could drive a car, 15 miles, because it was timed through stoplights and so on and so forth, and Nevada City seems like a great place to create some kind of bike commute type, barriers and things that make it very bicycle-friendly and shovel the cars off onto the main roads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some improvements that have been made and some connections need to be made between the different areas.
Yeah, and then integrating it with public transit. I worked in the public transit business for a while. That's one of the big problems, especially like here in the Bay Area. Just this morning they were talking about how that, more people ride bikes. They want to go on Caltrain. Well, Caltrain only allows, 12 bikes per train, and people drive all the way, they ride all their bikes all the way to the train station, and then they can't get on the train. That's just stupid. The transition points are very difficult in this country.
Mm-hmm. Kind of clunky there.
Yeah. We're fortunate to have our bus system. They all have bike racks on the bus, and I've never not been able to take my bike on the bus. But there are only two spaces, so it is possible that you could get kicked off the bus, or your bike could get kicked off the bus. So that is a concern.
So, and the other thing is that, we have this really great race called the Nevada City Classic, and I know how much you love that race, George.
I love watching that race.
Yeah, I hear the key word being watch, right?
I've never raced it.
That's amazing.
Well, every time it happened, I was a week away from traveling over to Europe, and if you look at the risk analysis factors, you look at high-risk events, and you cut out the top high-risk events, which is something I always did. Unfortunately, the Nevada City race is a high-risk event for crashing, and sitting on a plane for 14 hours with road rash is not fun. So the few times that I could have rode it, I didn't. I went, came up and watched it and drank beer, which is almost as fun.
Maybe we'll see if we can get you a job on the pink motor next year at the race riding VIPs with me.
Yeah.
I get the funnest job at the Nevada City Classic every year, at least for the past few years, and it's just so fun being behind the pack on the motorcycle, coming through the course, seeing the crowd. But going back to Nevada City, how I found out about Nevada City was I did the race, and I think it was 89 or 90 or something like that was the first time here. And, I got to agree with you, though. It's been dangerous every year. One year I raced it, and it was a a field of 120. I think that was the max field. Whatever the max was that year, it was maxed out. And I was in right in the middle point of the rear, you know, half and the front half. And after lap 10, boom, the cattle guard came open. We got disheveled out. So it's like I've only made it to lap 11 in this race.
Yeah, they need to narrow it down to top 30 or 40 riders, and then it'd be a great event.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely, it gets broken up.
Well, one of the great things about bike racing, you guys are talking about the Tour of Nevada City or any bike racing, is it's an event that you can go to, you can take your family, and it's free. You don't have to pay to go into a stadium, mm-hmm. you know. You don't go do that, and you know, a lot of the races are held right downtown, so you don't have to go out of town to do it. And it's a great opportunity for people to see a racing who might not otherwise see it, you know, people that commute to get a better taste for all of that stuff.
It's unlike a festival too. Like we have the Street Fest here, you know, through the summertime, and it's a way to see your city in a different light that is completely, you know, exciting, where you have these people blasting around the streets on bicycles and doing you know, riding their bikes real fast and putting on a great show.
Yep, you just need to get more kids out there.
That's right.
You need some kid events.
I hope the kids are listening right now.
I want to see a big wheel race come down Center Nevada City.
Well, they have that every year. There is a kids event every year, George. They go from the finish line down around through turn one, turn two, and then they've got ice cream at the end for them.
I think Emma's going to do it next year. I think your girls need to come and do it. We got a last caller here, so why don't we take this call? You're live on KVMR.
Thanks. Hey, Tim Helion here, guys. How's it going over there?
Tim Helion. Oh, my God. Who's that?
Yeah. I got three questions for George.
Okay.
Sure.
George Mount, Tim Helion here, Tour and A guy. Question, are you still racing?
And, no.
Nope. Do you ever consider jumping in Masters races? I mean, it's huge these days.
Well, I did it about 7 or 8 years ago, and I actually was riding Mount Hamilton. One of the years, I rode about 3 or 4 years of Masters races, and I was riding up Mount Hamilton, and I got about 2/3 of the way up, and I looked around, and I'm in the old farts race, and you can tell by looking at certain guys when they're doing drugs, and I saw a lot of guys that were doped up, riding their big chain rings up Mount Hamilton, and I turned to my friend, and I said, I'm done. See ya. Turned around, rode back to the car, tore my license up.
And you put your bike in the trunk, and that was it? That was your last day of racing?
I have no intention. I mean, you know, this is old farts racing bikes. There's no reason these guys should be doped to the gills.
Right.
And it's just no fun.
Right. Kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no bragging rights when you're doing drugs. Sorry.
There you go. Couldn't said it better.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Tim,
I mean, it seems like it's across the board. Juniors on up, isn't it? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's out of control, and the Masters are the worst. When I went to Italy as a professional, somebody told me, if you want drugs, you go to the what they call the Ciclo Amatore, which are essentially the Masters. And those guys, they're doctors. They have friends who are doctors. I didn't believe it, but now I see it happening here.
You know, I wanted just to interject here. People that don't know who this caller in is, Tim Helion. Tim Helion puts on the fabulous Tour de Nez up in the Tahoe area, and this year it was, 5 days of racing? It's a great stage race if anybody gets a chance next year. It's usually the week after the Nevada City Classic to get up and watch the Tour de Nez. It was very exciting this year. It was my first time at the Tour de Nez, and Tim puts on a great race. So, Tim, hats off to you for putting on such a great event.
Thanks. Yeah. I was kind of hoping we get George Mount up there next year.
Well,
I want to come up and watch.
Yeah, George can come
good.
Up. And George rides a motorcycle, too, and he hears you guys need a lot of BMWs up there.
yeah, you're the chief recruiter, right, Chris?
I guess I am now, if you say so. So, great. I think that's a great thing.
Cool.
Get George up there to the Tour de Nez, and it's nice fresh air and really great scenery and good racing.
Well, it'd really be an honor for us. That, you know, George is one of those highly regarded guys that we all looked up for years as one of the big shots in American racing, and sure took American racing internationally for some of us, which was a really neat thing. So, you know, George Mount was always a big deal, so it'd be really cool to have him up here, and always appreciate it. I was always a big fan, George.
All right. Well, I'll be up there.
Yeah,
cool.
Definitely. So thanks for calling in, Tim. And that's going to conclude our hour here of Bike Talk, but we want to kind of segue out with some more music here and thank people for calling in. And we look forward to our next Bike Talk, which will be September 17th. And if you have any questions or comments, you can go to the KVMR website and click on Bike Talk, and you can leave suggestions or comments. You can also go to kellybike.com to our news. Click on the news icon, and there's a blurb on Bike Talk right there, and you can leave questions or comments for myself or anyone at KVMR. I have a link for both set up on my website. And then, George, I just want to thank you for being on the air with us an hour. You're fabulous.
Hey, and anytime.
And, you know, it's always great getting together with you and talking. And, you know, it's, you know, for any of you that ever get to meet George, he's a great guy. And I hope I can have you on the air again in the future. And Kurt as well, Janelle.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.